May as well begin. Now, as I remember that last week, we did not finish the discussion of natural right and historical mindedness, and I want to do a thorough treatment of that because I think it's, as I've said, it's sort of a last, not last, because we got several years after that, but it's a testament of the meaning of an awful lot in Lorien's whole enterprise, all of his work. So we got up to the section that begins with the dialectic of history. So my notes, I think we could probably begin around from last week, the notes that I passed out last week, then I'll pass out new notes for today when we move on, would be number 20 on page 6. So what he's been talking about is raising the question of how to determine collective responsibility, what it is, and then from there moving to, well, are there any norms for any responsibility once you accept historical mindedness, once you accept the fact that new ideas emerge and they change the meaning of institutions, of cultural values, and so on. Is there anything that is normative? And then he appeals to nature as concretely operating, developing Aristotle's definition of nature as an immanent principle of movement and rest, and developing it along the lines of his intentionality analysis, where the desire for meaning and truth and value is a principle of movement, and the answers that come to the questions that are raised out of that desire are a principle of rest. And then he says, well, is that one nature or is it several? Well, they're all bound together and they're all part of this vertical finality, this underlying dynamism that is headed through intelligence, reflection, and deliberation to complete self-transcendence and being in love. All right, so then, moving on in section 3 to discuss the dialectic of history. Why does he bring this up? Because the concern for natural right or natural law, for norms in historicity, was prompted by the question of collective responsibility. To what extent do the norms in historicity that can be determined from his portrayal of natural law or natural right, be attentive, be intelligent, be reasonable, be responsible, to what extent do those norms have some pertinence not to individual responsibility, which is very clear from almost all of Lonergan's writings, but to collective responsibility, to the responsibility of a state, of a political order, a culture, a society, a community, a church, as a collective body, as a collective entity. And at this point, he introduces the phrase for the first time in this essay, and I believe in all of his writings, the normative source of meaning. The normative source of meaning. And that is this underlying drive to intelligibility, truth, and goodness that he's been talking about. This underlying nature as raising questions and finding answers for meaning, for truth, and goodness is the normative source of meaning in history. It's what he's been talking about all along, but so far, he says, it reveals no more than individual responsibility. But now what he's doing is providing in the rest of this essay a hermeneutic for the reading of, for the understanding of meaning as embodied in social and cultural institutions. So in a transposition, I think, of the Hegelian idealism of objective spirit, he writes the following on page 176. Only inasmuch as the immanent source becomes revealed in its effects, in the functioning order of society, in cultural vitality and achievement, in the unfolding of human history, does the manifold of isolated responsibilities, yours and mine and yours and so on, coalesce into a single object that can gain collective attention. So any social body that we would be studying is, he says, the objectification, the coalescence of the individual responsibilities of the people who have made it what it is at the present time. So we can give that then collective attention in that fashion, and that's the beginning of assuming collective responsibility for our group, for our city, for our country, for our church, for our religious community, whatever. Giving it attention as something that has unfolded as the effects of the coalescence of the individual responsibilities of the people who have made it what it is. And that's the beginning, paying attention to that, of assuming collective responsibility. But then, of course, we have to go on from paying attention to it to understanding it, how it got this way, to judging whether we've got that understanding correct or not, and to deciding, well, do we want it this way or should we be doing something different? Should there be changes made in the functioning order of the society, whatever it might happen to be? And the issue is dialectical. It's the dialectic of history. Number 21, the question is a real one because the normative source of meaning is not the only source. The norms can be violated. And any social body, any community, including the church, is a combination, at any state of its existence, is a combination of the coalescence of individual responsibilities and the coalescence of individual failures to be responsible. So to the extent that the norms are violated, we find in a social object, whatever it might be, the church, the city, the country, the community, not only social order, but also disorder. Not only cultural vitality and achievement, but also lassitude and deterioration. Not an ongoing and uninterrupted sequence of developments, but rather a dialectic of radically opposed tendencies. Then we find that the issues that in a single individual might be important for that individual, whether he or she is being attentive, intelligent, reasonable, responsible, they are very important for that individual because the success of one's project as a human being depends on that. But in the total fabric of social and cultural history, for the most part, they're infinitesimal in the individual. But when these are writ large in a social order, he says it takes on the dimensions of collective triumph or disaster. Civilizations do decay and die. And they decay and die because they've passed a point of no return in terms of the coalescence of failure to be attentive, intelligent, reasonable, and responsible. That can be an internal source. They can also be wiped out by external power that is beyond them. But there can be an internal source of disintegration, cultural and civilizational disintegration and decay. And the same thing can happen not only to civilizations, but to communities of all kinds. Civic communities, a city can fall apart. Toronto is going bankrupt at the present time. It's not all its own fault. It's because all of the expenses were downloaded on Toronto by the previous provincial government, and the present provincial government has not alleviated that. But the city, if it keeps up, is going to become not a very pleasant place to live and not too long a period of time, I'm afraid. That's just one instance. It's my view, but it's shared by others as well. But religious communities, educational communities, schools can fall apart, or they can lose their mission and their identity. Artistic communities, practical communities. So, in the dialectic of history, we find, quotes, the experimental verification or refutation of the validity of an entire way of life. An experiment devised and conducted not by human choice, but by history itself. And this is, if you read the last chapter in Topics in Education, he will talk about history, that what happens in history is not the product of any individual choice. It's beyond any of us what happens in history, what historians write about. And none of us can, by making our choices, well, we may or may not contribute to the outcome of history, but that outcome is far beyond us because it's the coalescence of so many different factors that none of us can be in touch with or on top of or in control of. So in the same dialectic, he says, we find the link between natural right and historical mindedness. The source of natural right lies in the norms immanent in human intelligence, human judgment, human evaluation, human affectivity. This is becoming more important for him as he goes on, affectivity. He's now got it in the transcendental structure in a way that it wasn't there before. And the vindication of natural right lies in the dialectic of history, and awesomely indeed in the experiment of history, That is to say, when civilizations decline and decay from within, it is because there has been a collective failure to be attentive, intelligent, reasonable, and responsible. Collective failure. Over time, and it can reach a point where a given society could even be beyond recall, and not because it's being conquered from outside, but because it has simply fallen apart from within. Okay, so that's the dynamic. And then the elements, the six headings, are taken up in pages from my book. But let me pause there for a moment and see if I've got it, you know, if I've expressed it in a way that's clear what he's after here. He's after us trying to pay attention to a reality that has coalesced out of. So with any situation, you know, we get a sense. You get a sense when you go into a situation, you know, whether it's relatively healthy or unhealthy. It's easier the smaller the situation. You go into a family, well, you can be in a family setting for a half hour and you know that it's either working or it isn't. Or a religious community, the same thing. Whereas a city or a country, it takes a little longer to get that. But to pay attention to what is happening and then to try to understand and understand as accurately as possible and to do something about it, that's the whole matter of collective responsibility and responsibility for the collective. But it's responsibility that has to be taken by the collective. You can have a prophet in a society naming what's wrong and why it's wrong. But if nobody's paying any attention to him or her, nothing's going to be done. The collective body has to take up the challenge or nothing will happen. How are we so far? I want to go into the six points.
Okay. Here you say, that in the dialectic of history we find the experimental verification or refutation of the validity of an entire way of life. An experiment devised and conducted not by human choice, but by history itself.
Yeah.
Why does he mean not by human choice, but by history itself?
It's the place to go for this is the the last chapter in Topics in Education, where he takes up history as a topic in education. In other words, he's really talking about the teaching of history. Everything throughout that book is the teaching of mathematics, teaching of science, teaching of art, and so on. But the teaching of history, and what he's after there is if you can communicate through the teaching of history that what happens in history, what historians write about, is not the product of any one individual's choices and decisions. It's way beyond that. What happens in my life is the product. I mean, if I'm being attentive, intelligent, reasonable, and responsible about my own life, then a lot of what happens in my life is the product of my own free choice. Not exclusively, because I could be bucked from the outside, I could be opposed, I could be, you know, forces working against me and all of that sort of thing. But I have some control over that. But I have no control over what's going to happen to the future of North America. You know, I can contribute to it. I can say something. I can make statements about it. I can vote for the right people and so on and so forth. But what's going to happen is beyond the freedom of any individual or even the isolated freedoms of many individuals. There are so many factors that simply escape human freedom.
So even if it's a person like Hitler, there was conditions and choices made in that environment that made it conducive for Hitler to come into power.
Oh, yeah.
So it's not just Hitler.
Yes,
that
right.
Made all those.
Yes, and of course, I mean, and then if you take Hitler, you see, he made a lot of choices, hoping to determine the future of history. Mm-hmm. But thank God, mm-hmm. he was stopped. You know, because there were others who gathered together and said, we can't allow this to happen. But even then, you start out with a battle, and who knows. The best generals in the world can lose battles, you know, because something might happen, a boat might get stuck on bringing the supplies or whatever, that is simply beyond the choice of anybody in the course of history. But Hitler's a very good example, and he was actually the one that I was thinking of in repeating what Lonergan is saying about history, because, you know, he would have determined a lot about history, and he did determine a lot, but ultimately he didn't get what he wanted. So it was beyond his power to control history. History is if it's in the hands, as it were, of any intelligent, reasonable, responsible being, that being is God, and it's not any human being. So, but this is put better than I've just been able to put it in chapter 10 of Topics in Education. That history is tied up with destiny, and destiny is more than what individual freedoms can control. Much more complex than that. We can persuade rationally and reasonably. We can also persuade by manipulation. And there's so much today, and I think I've said this before, in the political sphere, where can you listen in on an intelligent political argument today? It's all slogans. Very little, you know, real argumentation about values and ideals and so on. Very little. Slogans and cross-firing accusations back and forth, all in the interests more of power than of the good. It would seem anyway. And the ones who do take their stand on values and try to argue and persuade the community to those values, for the most part, don't get very far. They have to be manipulative if they're going to get anywhere. When a society reaches that point, there's been a collective loss of attentiveness, intelligence, reasonableness, and responsibility. We're back into the advertising techniques that are used to sell beer, you know, and the same techniques are being used to sell political parties, any of the political parties, some of them more than others, but all right, now, so then he sets forth the dialectic of history under these six headings. And I think this is the most nuanced presentation that he has in any of his writings of the dialectic of history. You know the general scheme of progress. There will be progress to the extent that people are attentive, intelligent, reasonable, and responsible. There will be decline to the extent that they are inattentive, unintelligent, unreasonable, irresponsible. And there is always the presence of grace, leading people to self-sacrificing love, through which there can be a healing of the effects of inattentiveness, stupidity, silliness, and irresponsibility. That's the general thing. But now it becomes much more nuanced. Except for perhaps some of the stuff that he wrote back in the 30s, most of which haven't been published yet. This is the most complete analysis of the dialectic of history. Now, if you start on 159 in my book, with at the top of the page there, the first step in the dialectic. The first step in the dialectic is, again, the affirmation of the principle of progress. Now, we've seen this already, but I just want to start with that. The principle of progress is this tidal movement of ongoing self-transcendence, the normative source of constitutive meaning in history. Be attentive, be intelligent, be reasonable, be responsible. And but now it's being studied as it exists in the community, and as the community is the embodiment transcendental drive. But the community may also be the embodiment as well of the violation of the transcendental drive. So we've seen that. Okay. The elements of the dialectic set forth under six headings. Now, because history itself is now in this essay being conceived as rooted in a total dialectical and communal source of meaning, that is to say, attentiveness, inattentiveness, intelligence, stupidity, reasonableness, responsibility, irresponsibility, intelligence, reasonableness, and silliness, responsibility, and irresponsibility, at the core of history, at the core of these six elements, there lies the issue of the development of meaning. So he's now viewing history as a matter of the development of meaning. History is meaning embodied and in ongoing development through social and cultural institutions. First point, then, is that human meaning, whether technical, social, or cultural, develops and expands in human collaboration. So it's not just one individual. We make our contributions, whatever we're doing, you know. And he says technical, social, or cultural. Well, you know, we make our contributions through technical contributions that we make. We make our contributions through social order, or what we do in the social order. Culturally, artists and philosophers and theologians and historians and scientists and so on and so forth, they're all contributing to this. But the development and expansion is through people picking it up and moving it on and collaborating with each other. Collaboration in the present and collaboration over time. Without it, you don't get anywhere. Nothing can be done just by the individual. It's always in and through human collaboration. There are individuals making significant contributions, but if the community doesn't pick up on them, they die out. Eric Vogelin has the example of what might be, and he's not sure about this, what might be a profound philosophical insight on the part of an Egyptian pharaoh by the name of Akhenaten into the meaning of being. If the text is correct, says Vogel, and I've just thought of this, or otherwise I would have done research on it before I came over here. If the text that has come down to us is correct, Vogelin says this was a profound break from the mythic mentality, and it was something that was comparable to the insights into the meaning of being that we're used to associating with names like Plato and Aristotle. But there was no cultural milieu to pick up on it. And so it's like a hapax legomenon. You know, it happened once and that's it. And it didn't stir anything in terms of cultural ferment, because the culture itself wasn't ready for a profound philosophical insight like this. There are other things that have to take place in the cultural order before something like this can have any effect. So it's human collaboration that is required for the development and expansion. So a person can have a great insight, can create a great piece of art, can write a great philosophical work. And you know, you never know when you write a book whether anything is going to happen to it. Hegel, for 7 years after the Philosophy of Spirit, I think the book sold 700 copies in 7 years. And then it took off. But it was nothing for a while. And that can happen. Insight, you know, when Lonergan sent in Insight, one of the readers for the original publisher, Longmans, Green, and Todd, and in Britain said, we're going to lose money on this, but we have to publish it. And, you know, they're not losing money on it now. But you know, and whether they ever did, I don't know. It's one of those books that sells steadily. It'll never be, you know, a bestseller, but steadily over time. Okay, so human collaboration. Secondly, these expansions of meaning occur on a succession of plateaus. And this is the thing like with the Ikhniton example. The Egyptian culture was on the first plateau. Ikhniton was expressing an insight on this, what Lonergan's here calling a second plateau. And the culture was just, you know, if anybody heard him say this, they would say, well, devil isn't talking. They weren't ready for this at all. So these plateaus correspond to the same thing that in method and theology he calls the three stages of meaning. The first plateau entails the development of practical intelligence. Intelligence in the realm of doing. The Egyptians building the pyramids. Great feats of engineering. Okay, so practical intelligence. The style of the development is the spontaneous accumulation of insights into the ways of nature and the affairs of human beings. Whatever awareness there may be of any reality being more than nature and humanity, divine, for instance, has little more than symbolic expression in the compact style of undifferentiated consciousness. But a second plateau involves a cumulative development and specialization of language. It has to do mainly with speech, and it leads to an eventual differentiation of consciousness in philosophy, mathematics, and science. Where this clearly happened in the Western cultural history is in Greece, in Athens, 4th century Athens, where there's this slowly emerging interest in scientific issues, and they got it all wrong for a while, but they were raising the questions. Thales thought everything was water, but at least he was pursuing philosophical issues. His answer, probably not right, but you know, the development of these issues. And then finally you get a Socrates who's really differentiating language and differentiating consciousness by the differentiation of language by asking people to say, what is courage? What is temperance? I don't mean pointing out to me a courageous person. I can see if somebody does something, I'd say, well, that was very courageous. But what is it? Define it. I couldn't do it. He couldn't do it. But he's forcing a differentiation by asking those kinds of questions. And then the third plateau is the one, so we've been in, since then, at least in the West, we have been on the second plateau down through the 19th century. I've hazarded the speculation that Hegel's philosophy of spirit was the end of the second plateau and the beginning of the third, because he thought that he had caught it all up, and maybe that's what he was trying to do, but he also thought that maybe history was coming to an end because he had caught it all up. Well, that hasn't happened. But the third plateau is one that we are only beginning to inhabit in our time, and very precariously so. People say, why is it that Lonergan's stuff hasn't really caught on? And I don't think it's because he's Catholic in a secular world, because he, you know, you wouldn't know that from reading Insight until you get to chapter 20. You know, you just say, well, he knows a lot about mathematics, he knows Einstein, he knows Heisenberg, he knows Marx, he knows Freud, and so on and so forth. But it's because he's on to something that we're just beginning to get into. The movement to a concern with human understanding, where developments originate, with the methods in natural science and in critical history, with the generalized empirical method that underpins both scientific and historical method to supply philosophy with a basic cognitional theory, epistemology, metaphysics of proportion of being. And anyway, that's, I mean, what he's basically saying is that insight is the entrance into a third stage of meaning. And I think that's why, you know, his stuff is caught on, but not to the extent that it really deserves to. Michael Fahey, the outgoing editor of Theological Studies, who was editor there for 10 years, said it's very clear from the submissions of articles that Lonergan is by far the most influential Catholic theologian writing in English at the present time. The influence of his stuff on the articles that are being presented. But you'd think it would be much more, at least if you're into it the way I've been into it, you know, you would think of it. But it needs something from the outside to kind of get people to really start paying attention to it. If Cardinal Martini had become Pope, Lonergan would be really big right now. You know, you need something like that. You need that kind of promotion from a whole different standpoint. They want to understand the Pope, and people say, you want to understand the Pope, you've got to understand Lonergan. Okay, then you get at it, you see. But it didn't happen, and it's going to be a while before that happens. But at any rate, what he's saying here is that things develop, and they develop slowly. But there is, you know, if enough of us pick up on it, we can keep this thing going. And if that's the case, then this third plateau will become a set of schemes of recurrence in history, and not just in individual lives. I mean, I think this way as much as I possibly can, but I want to see it spread out. I want to see it through the church, through our educational institutions and everything else. So anyway, this is meaning developing on a series of plateaus. The differences of plateau give rise to different conceptions of the dialectic operative within history. So people will see it differently at different times. Girard is into the same thing in his own way, that the dialectic operative within history will be understood in a very mythical way, and with a lot of, at least in Girard, if Girard is correct, with a lot of failure to notice what's really going on. The less developed are the resources of meaning in a given cultural matrix. And then when meaning becomes further developed, there's the suspicion that we can't any longer cover over our social violence with these myths. And Girard points out a lot of instances in the Middle Ages where, you know, people realized they couldn't create myths to do this. And now in our present time, we're beginning to see how violent we really are. And if that's the case, perhaps we can begin to do something about it. That's Girard. I mean, in a sense, he's got his three plateaus, and they are basically mythic, theoretic, and interiority. They really do unfold on that kind of level. And that's the way Lonergan lines them up. It's mythic, practical, theoretical, interiority as the three plateaus. So you get the notion of fate or destiny, or again of divine providence, understood in a very primitive kind of way. I don't think he's trying to mock the notion of divine providence, but understood in a very primitive kind of way. So that, in the sense, primitive in the sense that, well, maybe we don't have much control at all. And that can be a fatalistic kind of thing. The kind of thing that the Brazilian Paulo Freire was attempting to free people from, this notion of fate as controlling their lives. And then in Augustine and in Hegel and Marx, you get a different kind of formulation, much more rational, much more dialectical. Augustine, the city of God and the earthly city. Hegel and Marx, dialectical notions of history. Spengler, I don't know much about, but Lonergan was very much captivated by Toynbee, especially when he realized that Toynbee was not really writing history. He was creating models for understanding historical movements. And his study of history, which I want to read in greater detail than I've ever done now that I see how much it was significant for Lonergan, his study of history for Lonergan is kind of a heuristic opening onto our understanding of how meanings develop in history. So what would be an exercise in empirical method with regard to history? How is the dialectic of history conceived on the third plateau? his remaining 4 points formulate an answer to this question. In anticipation of what will emerge from these points, Lonergan comments that the notion of the dialectic of history that emerges on this plateau of interiority, okay, has its origins in the tensions of adult human consciousness, its unfolding in the actual course of events, its significance in the radical analysis it provides, its practical utility in the invitation it will present to collective consciousness to understand and repudiate the waywardness of its past and to enlighten its future with the intelligence, the reasonableness, the responsibility, the love demanded by natural right. The more that you get into this, the more you will have enough familiarity to have a sense of when a collective body is losing its way. This is the kind of argument that he's trying to develop here. The deeper you are immersed in interiority and its exigencies, the more habitual will become your ability to recognize when a collective body is on target and when it is losing its way. And then if you have the sense that it's losing its way, to pursue why and to see what can be done about it. All right, so on the third plateau, in our time, in other words, there are emerging new ideals of enlightenment and emancipation. Enlightenment now is not what it was even at the end of the second plateau, the first enlightenment, where it was, well, science can throw out myth. In other words, the second plateau can overcome the first plateau. It's basically what the Enlightenment, 17th and 18th century Enlightenment, was all about, was the second plateau moving definitively beyond the first. Well, the Enlightenment specific to the third plateau is self-appropriation. It's knowing what one is doing. When one is knowing, when one is choosing, when one is loving, it is also self-appropriation in the whole dimension of affectivity and symbol, psychic self-appropriation. That's the Enlightenment that we are about today. That's the Enlightenment that would happen if this third plateau takes hold. Self-awareness, self-understanding, self-knowledge, so that we know what the differences are between common sense, theory, interiority, history, so on. Natural right, what natural right or natural law is all about. Affectivity, knowing when it's really self-transcendent in love, in the family, in the community, in religion, in faith in God. And emancipation, the ideal of emancipation that is emerging in our time, is this freedom into self-transcendence. The freedom to be self-transcendent through intellectual, moral, and affective conversion. First and only time he's used that expression, any of his writings, affective conversion. Intellectual conversion, distinguishing the world of immediacy and the world mediated by meaning and the criteria appropriate to each of them. Moral conversion, acknowledging the distinction between satisfactions and values, committing oneself to values even when they conflict with satisfactions. Affective conversion, commitment to love in the home, to loyalty in the community, to faith in human destiny. Yeah, I'd like to... Thank you, Raleigh. Well, we have time before 3 o'clock and I do want to get through this, so... These ideals enable us then to engage in a critique of the past so that we can appropriate the past because it's made us what we are, but also know where we might have gone astray. A critique of what our past has made us. A critique that is concerned with the operative meanings constitutive of our social arrangements and cultural intercourse. There are movies, for instance, today that are being, that can tie into this. Documentaries about the movies such as A Corporation, the one that's on right now, which I haven't seen, Why We Fight. But these films, these documentaries, are attempting to do is to get at the meanings that have brought us into this situation that we're in today. The corporation is about the danger that we have of being taken over by corporate systems. And the Why We Fight is an indictment of... It starts with Dwight Eisenhower's warning to the American people about beware of the military-industrial complex. And it shows how the combination of militarism and industrial corporate mentality in the United States has by this time brought that country to the point where they must be engaging in war or the country can't profit. That's very serious. Very serious condition. So attempting then to point out that the operative meanings constitutive of social arrangements and cultural intercourse are profoundly depraved and need radical transformation, or the experiment of history is going to lead to the destruction of the most powerful nation that has ever existed. You can't go on like that. The country cannot survive like that. The human spirit will not tolerate it. So there's this critique, and it will be research assembling the data, interpretation grasping their significance, history narrating what's been going forward, and this can be done in books, but it can also be done in images like film. All of them on this, they're all third plateau types of activity. This is, you know, Lonergan on the edge, as it were. Right? Pointing these things out. Okay. And calling to the threefold intellectual, moral, affective conversion. Now, you get this diversity of results here. If some have been through the threefold conversion, others will have experienced only two, others only one, some none at all. And if there's really, I would still maintain that it's religious, moral, intellectual, and psychic conversion, then you've got four rather than three, and it gets even more complicated. But hence, we must be prepared for the fact that our researchers, our interpreters, our historians may exhibit, well, if it's three, it's an eightfold diversity of results. If it's four, I think it goes to 16, where the diversity does not arise from the data, but rather from the horizon, the mindset, the blick of those conducting the investigation. So you're going to get a lot of conflicts among people trying to interpret, well, how did we get this way and what can we do about it? But ultimately, those are going to depend on the presence or absence of these conversions and so on. Okay, so it's very complicated. And sometimes you wonder, is it so complicated that maybe this third plateau can't take hold? And I hope that's not the case. Because it probably must take hold. It probably has to. If we're going to have a future, a human future. Okay, and then we have to consider as well that the proper... what really makes the difference between the three plateaus is not time, but meaning. In other words, it's not like, well, first you have the first, and then you have the second, and then you have the third, although you can trace there is a certain amount of that. But right today, in this city, in this neighborhood, in this school, there are people living on the first plateau, there are people living on the first and second, and there are people living on the first, second, and third. So there will be meanings that will prove operative in people of action. Further meanings that will involve a familiarity with logical techniques, with system and so on, and a still further plateau of meanings that attain their proper significance in the appropriation of interiority. It's a shorthand for what he's saying. The basic categories then, the basic categories of analysis in this critique of what our past has made us and of the constitutive meanings that have emerged will distinguish developments, the handing on of developments, completeness and incompleteness in developments, completeness and incompleteness in the handing on of jobs. Okay, what does he mean by that? Let's read the long paragraph, which is right out of the Natural Right and Historical Mindedness. It's a rich analysis, and it reflects one way of talking about the movement from below and the movement from above. Development may be described, if a spatial metaphor is permitted, as from below upwards. It begins from experience, is enriched by full understanding, is accepted by sound judgment, is directed not to satisfactions but to values. And the priority of values is comprehensive, not just of some but of all, to reveal affective conversion as well as moral and intellectual. Now, notice now his connection of affectivity with values. But development is incomplete when it does not go the whole way upwards. It accepts some values, but its evaluations are partial. Or it is not concerned with values at all, but only with satisfactions. Or its understanding may be adequate, but its factual judgments faulty. Or finally, its understanding may be more compromised than a sound contribution. Again, the handing on of development, which is what we do in schools. All right? Education is basically a handing on of tradition. It's not only that, but that's a large part of it. The handing on of development may be complete or incomplete, but it works from above downwards. It begins in the affectivity of the infant, the child, the son, the daughter, the pupil, the follower. On affectivity rests the apprehension of values. It's becoming more and more a theme with him. It's our affective lives. There is where we apprehend values. On the apprehension of values rests belief. On belief follows the growth and understanding of one who has found a genuine teacher and has been initiated into the study of the great people of the past. Then, to confirm one's growth and understanding, comes experience made mature and perceptive by one's own developed understanding from below. With experiential confirmation, the inverse process may set in. One now is on one's own. One can appropriate all that one has learnt by proceeding as does the original thinker, who moved from experience to understanding to sound judgment to generous evaluation to commitment and love, loyalty, faith. It remains that the process of handing on can be incomplete. For instance, our handing on of the Christian tradition in the Toronto School of Theology, it may or may not be incomplete. If people are walking away with certain caricatures of some of the great figures of the past, then it's incomplete. This can easily happen. There occur socialization, acculturation, education, but education can fail to come to life. Or the teacher may at least be a believer, transmitting enthusiasm, teaching the accepted formulations, persuading that if a teacher never really understood, then he's not capable of giving the others the understanding that he himself lacks. So then it will only be by accident that pupils will come to appropriate what is sound in their tradition. And it's only by such accidents or divine graces that a tradition that has decayed can be renewed. So if you want to know, what some great thinker really was all about, the best thing is to engage in a seminar with someone who really knows that person, Whether they agree with the person or not, but really understands it from within, that this is the thing. But that's the handing on teaching. Then there are ambiguities of completeness. First plateau minds find meaning only in action. They don't find it anywhere else. They can live in a second plateau context where there are people doing a lot of other things. Or first and second can dwell in the third plateau where there are some people who are intent on interiority. But, it's like ships passing in the night, not understanding each other. Or the third plateau context, and this is a very, a provocative statement about where we're at today. Because there are a lot of different third plateau contexts, hermeneutics and language analysis and so on, they're all into this. but they can be marked by methodological blocks. And these are Lonergan's examples. In the contemporary academy, we can find the confinement of philosophy to ordinary language. Anything else? Forget about it. Or the restriction of knowledge to the exact sciences. Only the exact sciences are really knowledge. Or the insistence that human studies must be value-free. Or a limited openness to values that proscribes any talk of transcendence to God. Or, and now I'm adding this, the postmodern emphasis on otherness, fine. But you must acknowledge the ongoing process of self-transcendence to the other as a normative source of meaning. Otherwise, this fascination with otherness just becomes dabbling in differences. And it's, the issue is self-transcendence. Self-transcendence to the other in an attempt really to understand where the other is coming from. And then finally, this dialectic in history is not the final word. And this is something that we saw in the last issue, in the last article, too, in the ongoing genesis of methods, the movement beyond dialectical argument to dialogue, and particularly when there is authenticity even in the midst of differences. And the dialogue is what will show us that a lot of these issues of difference are not going to be resolved easily, and that there may be something a long way in the future that we are heading toward. And the only way we can head toward it is by understanding and engaging in mutual self-mediation with the other in dialogue, so that in conversation with you, you bring out something in me, or you affect me, and I affect you, and we go forward together towards something that we could never have envisioned when we started the conversation. Okay, so that's natural writing that reminded us. And then I, in my own book, go on into the psyche and add psychic conversion to the whole picture. So, lots of stuff. Can we take a minute before we break, and then we'll come back? Unless you don't. Yes, sorry.
So, in the article, he really does not get to answer explicitly what is collective responsibility. He's putting the framework for developing that later.
He's putting what it would be that we would have to attend to if we were, as a corporate body now, let's say that how many are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Let's say that the seven of us decided that we wanted to take collective responsibility for the revitalization of the whole atmosphere of Regis College. Okay. These are the issues that we would have to be concerned with in this institutional framework. The levels of the plateaus on which people are operating and how those plateaus are communicating with one another. How is the tradition being handed on? Is it a complete handing on of the scriptural, patristic, medieval, modern, contemporary riches of the Catholic tradition? A major, major critique of conservatives in the church, when they are absolutely right, is that Catholic theology departments have failed to hand on the Catholic tradition. It's a major, and they are absolutely 100% right on that. So that people, until very recently, were graduating from Catholic theology departments knowing nothing about the Cappadocian Fathers, or about Augustine, or about Aquinas, or, you know, that's a shame, that's a crime. That's the incompleteness of the handing on. All of these are the elements that we would have to take into consideration. If we were to decide that we wanted to assume collective responsibility to do what we could for revitalizing some institution, we would have to look at all of the things that he's covered here. It's a heuristic for collective responsibility, yes.
Well, I'm kind of wondering what... I recall having this conversation with a history professor, mm-hmm. in relation to long ago. Mm-hmm. And this person was saying, I'm not sure if she has read a lot of, or this work at least, but her impression was that Lonergan has this naive belief in progress in history, unqualified kind of history somehow progressing, you know, in a kind of a normative way. I also, I'm having that in mind. The other thing is, I'm also thinking how the whole idea of affective conversion, for instance, really brings in another element that you need to take care of. I mean, like, for instance, if you, I'm wondering how am I being related to history? And how is that mediation occurring? Through symbols and through the affect and so on.
Right.
So, in some sense, in those symbols, and there is no, is that, would you say that there is a normative movement, participation in progress? Or how does progress, decline, redemption play itself out there?
With symbols.
Within symbols, you know, and how that, so that kind of is complicated.
You're getting into where I was. Where I was moving next in these, because I wanted to bring in the whole thing of psychic conversion into the dialectic of history. Let me start with your first thing, and then maybe after we break, I'll come back to your question about psychic conversion and symbols and history and so on. So, I don't think it's correct at all that Lonergan has a naive trust in human progress. The section on moral impotence in Chapter 18 of Insight is one of the most, Insight is all of the book comes out of personal conviction. You can see that, but he's really speaking from personal conviction when he speaks of moral impotence and our incapacity for sustained development. He's much more a pessimist than he is an optimist. He's hopeful because he's a believer, but he's not an optimist. And there's no naive optimism. And it's very clear from some manuscripts of Insight that didn't get into publication that as he's nearing the end of the book, that humanity is facing the danger of total destruction, of totally destroying itself. And that was because of the nuclear thing, and he makes reference to that. Today it's not just that, it's also the environment and everything else that we're aware of. He only became aware of the ecological stuff in his late years, you know, see that you mentioned that only a few times. Mm-hmm. But he's not, that is, what he's saying is if there's progress, or whenever there is progress, real progress, it's because people were attentive, intelligent, reasonable, and responsible. But he's not saying naively that, oh, we are consistently attentive, intelligent, reasonable, and responsible. He's saying in Insight, in the section on moral impotence, we are not and we cannot be. We are incapable of it unless there is something else that can help us do that. That we cannot be consistently attentive, intelligent, reasonable, and responsible without God's grace. We can't be. So, you know, he's no more an optimist about history than Augustine was, or than Thomas, or von Balthasar. Von Balthasar, I have a lot of work to do on von Balthasar's theology of history, because von Balthasar has this thing, and it's also in Maritain, and it may very, very well be in Lonergan, but I'm not sure about this yet, that as history progresses, there's ever more good and ever more evil. As history moves on. But von Balthasar, he's got this vision of the growth of the good and the growth of evil. That the mammoth, and of course, you know, a 20th century person writing in the context of the European history, profoundly affected by that. His dissertation was in literature and was entitled The Apocalyptic of the German soul. You know, it's So he was into that kind of struggle in German literature. This is von Baltimore. Okay, let's break, and then I will address the thing about symbols and psychic conversions. But, you know, I can see, I mean, people think that because there are some people, and particularly in postmodern, it's a postmodern kind of thing. I don't know whether your professor history professor was into, but there is a postmodern kind of thing that, well, really, progress and decline are really, it's just what is, you know. It's not progress or decline. That Lonergan would disagree with. Mm-hmm. So if there's a criticism of him that there's any mention of progress, well, then you have to say, you know, let's just take Western civilization. Are we better off because Plato and Aristotle differentiated the second level of consciousness from the first? That's basically what they did. They differentiated understanding from experience. Or not. Was that progress or wasn't it? Well, I'm firmly convinced it was progress, you know. And that we're much richer because we have Plato's dialogues and Aristotle's metaphysics. And, you know, are they perfect? No, but they're better than, you know, pure basic consciousness, for heaven's sake, you know. But maybe not everybody would agree with that. And then, Thomas differentiated the third level. Mm-hmm. Augustine differentiated it with the truth, but Thomas got judgment. And Kierkegaard, a fourth level, you know. And Lonergan pulled them all together. That's progress. That's just one, in one area, this philosophical progress, but there is. And Aristotle, he was certainly aware of that, you know. He credited Plato with allowing him to do what he did, you know, and Plato made these advances and so on. Anyway, I'm going on. Let's take a break.